Hey guys, great to see you today. I'm so glad you're in the house. And so thank you, especially those of you who are here for our first time today. We're glad to have you. And help me, all of you, to say thank you to all of these men that have been here early helping to prepare breakfast for us this morning. They did a really, really good job. Actually, right on the heels of last night, we had a dinner here, and they had steak and baked potato last night. I wondered if you might have steak and eggs, but I know you enjoyed the great meal that you had this morning. Just a few days ago, there was some interesting information in USA Today newspaper, really in all the news outlets, but it was about the death of a legendary Hollywood icon, Kirk Douglas. He died at the age of 103 years old. He literally was about 10 or 12 years older than the Oscar Awards. And so an amazing guy. He was known for all kinds of big scale pictures, magnificent movies, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. But probably the signature of it all was Spartacus, where he played as the great gladiator, the great warrior, Spartacus. And it was a part of the golden era of Hollywood. Many of you remember last week that I told you that one of my favorite quotes about distraction is about Anaimus that said, "A gladiator's first distraction is his last." And we talked about that and distractions. But not only was Kirk Douglas a phenomenal Hollywood figure, but he had three sons, Peter, Joel, and his son, Michael. And Michael Douglas has had quite a stellar career of his own, both in television and in motion picture. In 1987, Michael Douglas starred in a movie, a psychological thriller, where he played a New York lawyer who was married, who had a daughter, and he went to meet a client, a woman by the name of Alex. And as things unfolded in the movie, his role as the lawyer, the lead character in Alex, had an affair. And it was a decision and a deception that he thought he could manage. He kind of thought it was a little one-time weekend rendezvous, kind of one and done. But the fact was that Alex became obsessed with him. The movie ends in his home, in his kitchen, with Alex wielding a butcher knife. Needless to say, it's not a story with a happy ending. But I say that to you to say that that film was based upon a short film originally titled Diversion. But the name by which the film has been known and has been archived is simply this: Fatal Attraction. Fatal Attraction. And Fatal Attraction was a tremendous reminder of warning that what you think might be a little distraction, a little diversion, can ultimately become something very destructive in your life. Because when you lose your focus, when you begin to go off course, it may seem just like a very little thing at the beginning, but ultimately it will take you places and ways that you never imagined. So the issue of diversion, attraction, distraction is what we're talking about, because I think it's such a big issue for us as men. I gave you this definition of distraction last week, and let me just put it back up there for you. Distraction is the temptation to give the focus and energy needed for something highly important to something that is often quite insignificant. Let me read it one more time. Distraction is the temptation to give the focus and energy needed for something highly important to something that is quite often insignificant. Distractions in all of our lives cause us to miss opportunities. They cause us in life to keep us from reaching our potential. They many times become the reason for the drain of energy that we have in life and can take us to places of guilt and destruction. And distractions can become fatal attractions in our lives when we begin to follow the path of destructive things. So today, I thought that it might just be good, having last week talked about facing the reality of the gravity of distraction, for us today to talk about identifying your fatal distractions. What are the potential distractions that could really be significant, fatal distractions in your life and in mine. And in order to sort of set the groundwork for this, I want to take a page out of a pastor's playbook. There are three specific books in the Bible, in the New Testament, that are written to talk about the assignment, the responsibility of my life, of my job, of my ministry. They're the books of 1 and 2 Timothy and the book of Titus in the New Testament. And in 1 Timothy chapter 4, Paul, who is a seasoned veteran pastor, apostle, leader, is writing to a young man, and he's trying to give him direction and information. And here's how he sort of closes out the fourth chapter of 1 Timothy. He says, practice these things. Immerse yourself in them. You know that word immersion, don't you? The word immersion means to be completely put into. We've talked about immersion journalism during a war when they put them in there and they're in the front lines of the battle. We know a lot about immersion in the Baptist church. Did you know that? Yeah. It means putting people all the way under. Some of you got a little bit like a little rainstorm, but Baptist, you get it all the way. You get the tidal wave, man. You go under. And boy, do I ever have some experiences of things that have happened in baptistries I could tell you about. The immersion. But practice these things, immerse yourself in them, so that all may see your progress. In other words, he's saying the things I'm telling you, you need to be sure that these are things that are constantly becoming your way of life. And then he ends with this verse, keep a close watch on yourself and the teaching. Persist in this, for by so doing you will save both yourself and your hearers. That's a real obvious thing for me as a pastor, isn't it? Don't be a hypocrite. Be careful that you're paying attention to who you are and what you are, as well as what you're saying. Be sure there's not something coming out here that's not in here, that's not down here in your feet. Be sure that you're living out a sense of life that is focused. Because when you get distracted, it won't be long until you've gotten derailed. Christopher Columbus said this, by prevailing over all obstacles and distractions, one may unfailingly arrive at his chosen goal or destination. You got to know how to deal with the distractions. And so I think us identifying these today is very important for each and for all of us as we're in this room. In his book, Indistractable, How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life, Nir Eyal tells the story about something that's very interesting, very familiar to us in terms of the sound of the word, but he tells us a story about the Greek figure Tantalus. Tantalus. You know the word tantalizing, don't you? And we think about something being tantalizing as being something that is out there, but it seems to be just beyond our reach. Well, there is within Greek mythology the story of this one Tantalus, who was a son of Zeus, who was punished and was banned and was put into the place of hell. But he was put into a pit of water that was right about the level of his knees, and there was a beautiful tree over his head where there was ripe fruit hanging just above him. And Tantalus, whenever he would reach up to get the fruit would move just beyond him, just where he couldn't quite get to it. And when he would reach down to scoop up the cool water to get a drink, he couldn't get the water because it would begin to recede below him. And so the whole story of Tantalus is about someone who always had a desire that was just beyond his reach, something that he thought that if he could get it, it would fulfill him, only to ultimately the moral of the story is because he was in hell, he really didn't need anything because there was no desire to be fulfilled. It was just endless desire. And so that's where many of us live. We live our lives distracted. And so today, as I've mentioned, I want to be sure that we talk about these distractions. Now, there are a lot of different kinds of distractions. Some of them are nice things, good things. Not all of them are deep, dark, hidden webs of deceit and darkness. But things that oftentimes seem harmless are a little bit like this sign I'm putting up right now. I would put a picture up here, but it would distract you. And it's amazing how it just can be just a little thing that can distract us in life. So let me identify, if I may, what I've been thinking about, what I've kind of been working through for me as well in recent days. Seven fatal distractions for men. Seven fatal distractions for men. And guys, we gotta jog, we gotta run. If we're gonna do seven things, you gotta run with me to get there. But we're gonna do it and do it together. So here we go. Number one, information. One of the most significant points of distraction in life for us today is information. For all of the things that make it easy for us to manipulate us and to break our concentration, one of the biggest is just the ongoing output of information and our attentiveness to it in the world in which we live. We have an alarming amount of information floating around in the world. And because of this, with all of the devices that we have alerts and we have alarms and we have push notifications, and all kinds of information is coming to us over and over again. News, weather, sports, reminders, constant communication. And it's become something that is such a big deal in life. I need to know. I need to know now. I need to know this. I need to see this, that we're constantly breaking our concentration to indulge ourselves in some form of information. As I was studying about this, I was absolutely surprised and fascinated to learn about a curious discovery. In 1925, Hugo Gernsback created this. It was called the isolator. Now, while it looks like some sort of a deep sea diving device, the truth is it was made for desk work, because there were people who were working in manufacturing where there was a lot of noise and movement. The other people trying to work at a desk couldn't focus. And so they decided to try to create a means to help people be able to block out the noise, to narrow their field of vision, to focus on the one thing that was in front of them. The actual caption on this picture was, "The author at work in his private study, aided by the isolator. Outside noises are being eliminated. The worker can concentrate with ease upon the subject at hand." Can you imagine an office full of that? I promise you, a lot of people be sleeping, no doubt about it. But the isolator. And many of us are just struggling with so much information that we're struggling to be able to isolate and to concentrate in our lives. But the issue is that when we compromise our attentiveness and lose our concentration, we ultimately lose vital energy for accomplishment and achievement in life. So much of the information that you and I are taking in today is nothing more than chewing gum for the mind. It comes in, it's there for a moment, nice little taste, and then it's gone. It's just like chewing gum, and you're spitting it out. But the problem is you're not getting anything substantial. You're not getting anything substantial that really helps you to think, and you're not necessarily getting anything that helps you to achieve what you need to do, and the result of that can be something very difficult. Herbert Simon said this, "The wealth of information means the dearth of something else, a poverty of attention." And attention and focus are the raw materials of both creativity and flourishing. So we have to learn how to disconnect. And I will talk about that at a future date. So number one is information. Number two for men is irritation. We get distracted by our irritations. Anger is everywhere in our world today, and it seems that it is more popular and it is more acceptable than ever to live in the ticked off mode. And a lot of men are just ticked off. It happens in our cars. It happens as we look at social media and we ignite over some little jot of information that comes in front of us. And we have a tendency to flame up in a variety of different life experiences. And the problem with anger is it's fun. It's fun to get mad. It's fun to blow steam. It's fun to just sort of indulge that. But it's a very destructive behavior in our lives. We quickly forget that anger is just one letter removed from danger. Take the D off and you got anger. Put the D on and you got danger. And there's a lot of danger to be associated with it. But for some reason, men enjoy the combustible things. You know, from the earliest years of life, men, boys, love fire. Can you agree with that? Did you like fire when you were a kid? You'd probably still go out and like fires, don't you? I'm not going to take confession for arson today, but just saying that we like fires. I remember I was about, I don't know, goodness, it was a long time ago, but I still have this memory as vividly as it can be. I was probably about 12 or 13 years old. I decided, I was living in the 70s, now I know for some of you that's ancient history, it's as far back as, you know, Spartacus, but I was living in the 1970s, I was kind of barely coming into my teenage years. I was living in the era of the peace and the peace sign. So I decided one day I'd go out to my dad's shed and I took a can of gasoline and I poured a peace sign on the ground in the backyard. I will never forget when I struck that match and threw it there. Boom! I mean, I had an explosion. I had a fire as tall as I was on the ground. And needless to say, I had quite some explaining to do to my dad about how he got that burn in the back of his yard. I just still remember, though, the surprise. I kind of thought it'd be like a little burn, you know, kind of this neat peace sign. I didn't get a peace sign. I just got a big burnout in the middle of the backyard. And believe me, there was no peace in my house once my dad saw it. But I say all that to say that we always minimize the consequence of those things that are explosive and combustible in life. We tend to downplay them. We tend to minimize them. And yet, anger is one of those things in our lives as men that have bad consequences for the people that you love and the people that live with you. Paul, writing in the book of Ephesians, said this. He said, "Be angry and do not sin." Now, let's just pause there and say that Paul understands as a man that getting angry happens in this world, right? There's several reasons that we get angry in the world. One, the pressure from the outside, things that create stress. And when we get under stress, we get agitated and irritated and we want to lash out. Because we feel like we're getting pushed into something. There's pain. Pain is always a cause of anger. I mean, I've told you this before. Put your hand here, take a hammer, hit your fingers. I promise you what you will feel will be rage. Rage and then obviously the damage. But at the end of the day, anger is this burning, this churning, this explosion that goes on inside. And then we have anger because of problems, things that we can't control in life, and we're trying to deal with them, and we get mad about them, things people say, things people do, things that happen to us. And so all of these things work in our lives. But Paul says, no, you're not going to go through life never being angry. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. That is, be sure that you don't become accustomed to allowing anger to become a boiling pot inside of you. And then listen to the last part of this verse, and give no opportunity to the devil. No opportunity to the devil. That's Ephesians 4, 26 and 27. The distraction of internal irritation will soon lead to destructive activities, especially involving your tongue. So we have information, that's a distraction, irritation. A third thing for men is recreation. Recreation. Now, recreation is good. It's a very necessary part of life. And the fact that we need to have diversion and that we do need to have times in life where we sort of downshift and shut down and renew and restore ourselves is important. But on the other hand, it's possible for a recreational pull to overcome responsible focus in your life. And there are an awful lot of men that I know and that I have observed in life who probably are best pictured in the image that I've got here for you to see right now. It's a little creature called a sloth. Now, he's a happy sloth. But have you ever watched a sloth? I mean, everything they do is in slow motion. It's like everything they do is just like, you're like, can he not move his arm faster than that? I mean, it's just amazing. But what happens for many of us as men is we become slothful. We allow recreational things, good things, necessary things, to begin to not so much restore and renew us, but to just distract us. In fact, in our world today, the most famous form of recreation is what we call entertainment or amusement. Now, if you know what amusement is, don't you? Muse means to think. If you put the a prefix in front of it, what does it mean? Not to think. And a lot of what we do is just not thinking. We don't want to think. We don't want to be focused. We don't want to concentrate. We just want to be amused. And so we let any little form of amusement become a means of diversion in our lives that ultimately can become very destructive. Michael Hyatt said this. He said, when we get stumped on something tough, it's tempting to give our brains a rest by switching to something more enjoyable. Because it's hard to think and concentrate and focus, it requires discipline. It's very easy to just sort of want to put that aside and just simply enjoy the amusement of something else. Proverbs chapter 12, Solomon, the wise man writing, says this, Whoever works his land will have plenty of bread. But he who follows worthless pursuits lacks sense. And then again in verse 24 of that same chapter, he says, the hand of the diligent will rule while the slothful will be put to forced labor. You're just doing nothing but losing the control of your life when you are giving yourself to what you think is a control, but it's really just a cruise control that will ultimately take you off course in life. Lethargic, loveless, lazy, losers. It's what we become when we let sloth rule in our life. So recreation needs to be a source of renewal, but never let it be an excuse for becoming lackadaisical in your life. Now let's flip the coin and go to number four, and that's ambition. The opposite of recreation is ambition. A lot of men are not just distracted by recreation, but we're distracted by our ambitions, our desires, our energy. We become so preoccupied with where we want to be and what we want to get in life. We're so interested in both our image and our presentation of ourselves that we ultimately allow ambition to overwhelm us. And the appearance of success and the allure of progress and the attraction of certainty that I'm confident, I got this, I can do this in life, becomes something that sets us up for a fall. Clay Scroggins, in his book, How to Lead in a World of Distraction, said, if you are not careful, you will let the external noise of success distract you from the internal work that will lead you to growth. And the secret is not what you're appearing to be here, but what you are becoming in here. So many profiles that I have seen and read, bios, all kinds of things that people show, always try to present themselves as being something or doing something that they are not. And just be careful about getting caught up in your ambitions when there is a sense in which you present an appearance that is different from the actual significance of your life, your work, your capability, your contribution. We need to protect and not compromise our integrity, because human beings are incredibly capable of lying at every level. We are. Deceitfulness is a part of the sinful fall within us. And one of the things that we all have a tendency to do is to present something about ourselves that's not really true to ourselves. So how many of you have ever lied? How many? This week? Let's go ahead and just get it up there, okay? Now let's. How many of you have lied? Just say, I've lied. I've lied about myself. Okay, let's just say that. Come on now, quit putting your arms down. This is public confession. This is how we do it in the Baptist church, okay? Some of you go in those little booths. We don't do that. We get bold. We get out here with it. I just want you to look around, because you have got a bunch of ambitious liars around you this morning. You do. We get caught up in these things. And when we do, it ends up becoming something very destructive to us. John Ortberg said this. He said, life is not about any particular achievement or experience. The most important task of your life is not what you do, but what you become. What are you becoming? Is the ambition of your life to grow, to become, to contribute, something of character and quality? Or are you just trying to create some sense of people, making other people think you're important so that you'll make yourself feel like you're more important? Guys, ambition can be such a very destructive thing. Ambition is the focus on doing rather than being. A number of years ago, I always remember a story told by Dr. James Dobson, who was originally the founder of Focus on the Family, and James Dobson's on radio across the nation every day on his radio broadcast, even today. A lot of great material on marriage, family, those kinds of things. But I always remember him telling the story about how one night he, when his family was young, he was sitting around a table and they were playing Monopoly together. And suddenly he got on a roll. And he said, you know, I started buying up all the property. I got Boardwalk, I got Park Place, I got the railroads, I got, you know. He said, boy, everybody started falling on my property and I started raking in the money. And he said, it was just incredible. He said, I was just stacking it up and everybody else was losing property. And he said, finally, a few minutes later, we came to the end of the game and everybody else was mad and ticked off by his attitude because he was, you know, he was monopolizing the board. And everybody just got up and went to bed, and he was left with the Monopoly board sitting there in front of him. He said, so I thought, oh, well, I won. And he said, I got up and started putting all the stuff, you know, picked up all the little cards and stacked them up, put a rubber band on them, and I got all the little pieces and put them back. And then I folded up the board, and he said, I put it in the box, and I reached for the top, and he said, as I did, he said, suddenly I realized this is really a picture of life. Because when it's all said and done, everything just goes back in the box. That's where it all started. It just back in the box. And we get all these ambitions in life, and we get all fired up about what we think people are seeing us do, and they're watching us achieve, and they're watching us, you know, get the monopoly on this and that. And at the end of the day, frankly, nobody cares about us because the only thing we cared about was ourselves. Be careful that you don't fall prey to the distraction of ambition in your life. Now, this one's going to get uncomfortable. Gratification. Most of our behaviors in life, especially when it has to do with a lot of self-care, has to do with craving and desire in our lives. One of the biggest cravings that's a distraction to men is hunger. Men like to eat. Men like to eat meat, right? I mean, I know we've probably got a vegan or two in the room, but most of us like to eat meat. Sorry, I didn't mean that to sound, you know, like a Trump tweet. But anyway, most of us like to eat meat. We like food, and we enjoy just taking it. I mean, frankly, that's why I serve you breakfast. You'd think, I think for a minute you'd come if I just offered a little bit of, you know, some fruit and a little bit of juice and coffee and I said, I'm going to be in here speaking. You just flock into this room like this. They don't set up extra tables because I'm coming out here to speak. They set up extra tables because you got here to eat. And you want to eat. And amen. Thank you. I thought somebody ought to say an amen somewhere. Exactly. Because we like to eat. But guys, overindulging in food and drink is something that can not only be a distraction, but it can become hazardous to our health and our well-being. And I am well aware, as you are well aware, that one of the great crises that we are facing as a nation is a problem of obesity. And let me just quickly say, I grew up in the South. And from my childhood, I have to say, I like fried in my mouth. I do. I like fried chicken. I like French fries. I like onion rings. I like fried okra. I like, you name it, you fry it, I'll eat it. I mean, that's kind of where I am. I like fried food, fried green tomatoes. I also like sweet things. I like cakes and anything baked. Now, I only like two types of pies, hot pie and cold pie. Those are the only kinds of pies that I like. I like fried foods. I like sweets. On top of that, I'm a Southern Baptist. That means that there have been many times in my life that I've gathered around tables with groups of men like you. And someone at that table has offered this prayer, Lord, bless this food to the nourishment of our bodies. And when I open my eyes and see a chicken fried steak and a loaded baked potato, sometimes I have to ask, can God really answer that prayer? I mean, honestly, it's a hard prayer to answer. Now, let me be sure you understand, I'm not trying to make you feel guilty about breakfast, okay? And this isn't intended to say, are you feeling heartburn or indigestion right now? I mean, hey, I love a great breakfast like you do. We just can't do this 7 days a week. It's one thing to enjoy it and to have an indulgence, but somewhere we got to have some boundaries and borders in life. And I'm not, this isn't an announcement that we're going to go continental, okay? So that's not it. That we're not setting the stage. I promise you, we're going to serve you breakfast when you come, because I want you to come. And so as a result of that, but I say that to say, this is a very real thing that we all have to deal with in life because it becomes a distraction to us in life. The craving for food is often a craving to resolve anxiety and other things in our lives. And believe me, as a guy who's lived an awful lot of his life driven by adrenaline, it's been very easy for me to let anxiety be a part of my life every day. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 12, Paul said this, "All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be dominated by anything." The very next verse says, food is meant for the stomach and the stomach for food. He's talking about eating. He's talking about the ways that we eat. And I don't believe that there is any sort of a dietary restriction that is put upon us from a spiritual means as that this is the only way to eat. God has made food. Take it, enjoy it, give Him thanks for it, including the chicken fried steak covered in gravy. But realize that you don't need to let something dominate your life that can destroy your life. Over the last few months, I've lost almost 20 pounds. And that's how I got this amazing body that you're looking at today. Overeating can be very intimidating. And I have to tell you, I like to eat until I can't eat anymore. That's just how my dad taught me clean plate club. That's how I grew up. You eat it until it's gone, you know. And you get a second helping after you do that. And that's even better. But letting food become a distraction for comfort is something that can be very dangerous. In May of 2018, I had 4 stents put in my heart. And it was certainly not just because of diet, though I'm sure it had some level of contribution. I have been aware, though, that I have a life history of heart disease. My family, my grandfather, I had a massive heart attack in his 60s that incapacitated him. My dad had open heart surgery before he was 60. And so here I come along, and I ended up finding one day on a table that I needed 4 stents. And that was great. But that was in May of 2018. And I didn't do anything after it was over. I probably weighed the most I'd ever weighed in my life, but I figured I'd got clearance, so go back to eating again, right? I mean, once you got stents, you're clean. Pipes are clear. Go for it. But I have to be honest. I've been spending some time in the last few months thinking about how much I love my wife and how much road I still want to cover with her. And I've got 6 amazing grandkids, and I really want to enjoy my days with them. And I've got 2 kids, a son and a daughter, who I just love being a part of their lives and watching them. And I want to be a part of these things. And I realize that though it would be easy for me to just say, hey, it's not that bad, you know, that it would be easy for me to let this become a stumbling block. So just saying to you, to me, be sure that food and cravings are not a distraction from something that will keep you from the best of life. And be sure that you're not letting your love of food keep you from greater loves that are in your life. I realize I quit preaching. I went to meddling, as the old farmer told the pastor. But I feel like it needs to be discussed because I think it is a distraction. The next distraction, the 6th distraction for men, is isolation. Isolation. Strange, but men have a way of becoming loners. We don't like people in our face, in our space, and in our business. It's just kind of how we are as men. We're territorial about that. You know that during that there are times of the year when we see deer in our community, but you see a lot more does than you see bucks. That buck kind of stands alone. He's kind of to himself. He's isolated, and that's kind of how we all want to be. We all kind of want to be that, you know, that stag that's out there unto himself. And it's such a big thing in life for us, and yet it is such a dangerous thing. I can't tell you how many times I've had wives say to me, you know, my husband, he just doesn't have any friends. He doesn't have any friends. And it's because so many of us, frankly, have isolated ourselves from people because relationships bring demands, and sometimes we'd rather just be disengaged. Again, Solomon, writing to his son in the book of Ecclesiastes, said this, "Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil." That is, teams can make a difference. You can go further together than you can go alone. And then he says in verse 10, "For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up." Don't get distracted by this kind of little temptation for isolation in your life. Because life is not a do-it-yourself, go-it-alone experience. John Maxwell, who's written a lot of books on leadership, has said this about leadership. He said, people who lead well know a secret. They can't trust themselves. Don't trust yourself. Realize that isolation can be a distraction in your life. So then we come to number 7. That wasn't too bad, was it? That's 6 of them. Talked about information, irritation, recreation, ambition, gratification, isolation. But the one that we all know and are all too familiar with is seduction. One of the biggest distractions for men has to do with destruction. We live in a world of constant distraction through images and fantasies and imaginations of sensual desire and carnal interest. And men are driven by the eye gate. I mean, that's just a fact. We are distracted by what we see. We are led by our eyes. And we are very quickly prone to turn down a street that says wrong way and yet refuse to turn around. And so that's what so many of us do in life. So let's not minimize the reality of the issue in a world in which we live of so much sensation. The truth is that sex, and not the opposite sex, but the reality of sexual desire, becomes a distraction in all of our lives because it is rooted in something deeper that the Bible describes and simply calls lust. It's not what's out there that's your distraction, it's what's in here. It's what's wrong with the desire that is in you. It's what's bent, twisted inside of you. In the sense that if it's going to rule your life without the parameters and without the direction that God has given to it, it becomes something that is much more overwhelming in your life. Now, lust is fueled by pride and anger and anxiety. The Bible describes lust in a very specific fashion and the role in temptation in James chapter 1. The Scripture says, let no one say when he is tempted, I'm being tempted of God. See, men, we all want to look out there and say, it's those women. And then we want to say, and God made them, so I guess I'm supposed to just enjoy them all. But the truth is, it's what we want to think about those women, how we want to use those women, which is a part of a deeper desire of something called lust inside of us. And so we've got to address this issue. No one can say, I'm tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil. But He Himself tempts no one. Each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth what? That's not a good outcome, is it? That's not the outcome you want. You want to live, you don't want to die. And so the reality is that lust is a means of destroying your life. Interesting to me how much the context here sounds like fishing, lured and enticed. You know, a good fisherman knows the right place, doesn't he? He knows the right place to go if he's going to find the fish. He also chooses the right lure. He chooses the one that's going to hit the water in the right way, whether it's under or over, or whether it's top water or whether it's something they're going to pull underneath the water. And then he's going to work that lure. He's going to work it in a way in which as he gets it going, he's going to work it and move it until finally what happens? The fish gets hooked. And then once the fish is hooked, all that's left then is just reeling them in. And that's what happens in our lives because of lust, unbridled, lust that we do not become attentive to and concentrate upon and seek to deal with becomes a lure that ultimately is used, and one day we become a display in Satan's trophy room. You've got to guard your internal thought life and desire. And lust is something that becomes such a powerful destruction for us as men. Through the years that we've done this, I've shared a lot of different passages of Scripture out of the book of Proverbs about the destructive power of lust and desire and sensuality. But probably the most powerful sort of vivid illustration of it is in the life of a man whose name is Samson in the Bible. You can read about him in Judges 14 to 16, and I would really encourage every man in this room to read Judges chapter 16. I don't have time to read all of that today, but Samson, like Spartacus, was a mighty man, a warrior. From his childhood, he'd been set apart to be a man of God. And the symbol of this was that his parents never had his hair cut. He was given to what was called a Nazarite vow. And this vow was an expression of a man whose life had been devoted to God. I'm glad, well, you can tell I didn't take a Nazarite vow because my hair is not only not cut, it's not there. But Samson knew that this was the symbol of God's favor and goodness in his life. But then what we see in the life of Samson is a man who's just reckless. He's just constantly reckless. And in Judges 14, he tells his parents, "I want a wife, and I've seen one that I want." He talks about how much he's seen these women, and over he talks about what he sees and that he's going to get what he wants, because Samson was a powerful man, a mighty man, a man more powerful than other men. He ruled by his dominion, of his strength, and of his might. But in Judges 16, he meets a woman by the name of Delilah. Delilah was bait. That's all she ever was. She never was interested in Samson. She was bait. She was set up by a group of people who were paying her. She was a prostitute who wanted to find the secret to Samson's strength so that she could bind him and could destroy him and would take him down so that his enemies no longer had to fear him. When you read Judges 16, you talk about a scene as she's asking him and talking to him about his strength and where it comes from, and he keeps toying with it and playing with it and getting closer and closer to the edge. He's having fun with his little distraction and attraction. Until one day, he tells her, and ultimately he is taken. The outcome of Samson's life was that, yes, she cut his hair, they took him and they burned out his eyes, and they bound him to a mill. And he became like a beast in a mill, just going around every day. The end of Samson's life is a sad thing. There's one final chapter of glory that you can read. But all of that to say, the life of Samson teaches us this. If you could read Judges 16, it's about sex, Samson, and suffering. And three lessons that we learn. Sin takes you further than you want to go. Sin keeps you longer than you want to stay. And sin's going to cost you more than you want to pay. Guys, learn this about seduction. It takes you further than you want to go. It keeps you longer than you want to stay. And it's going to cost you more than you want to pay. That's our problem, is that in the midst of seduction, we're always minimizing the consequence. We're always thinking that, well, it's not going to happen to me. But then the girl gets pregnant, or the adulterous relationship gets discovered. Somebody that you did love and care about ends up being devastated. The porn begins to be exposed, and it becomes a brokenness of trust in a relationship, in a marriage. And it becomes an obsession for you. And so as a result of that, we end up becoming dominated by our lust. John Ortberg said this, "Real freedom is not the external freedom to gratify every appetite. It's the internal freedom not to be enslaved by our appetites." Now, guys, the secret to overcoming distraction is not gritting your teeth, resolving that you're going to do better and try harder. It's not just saying, "I'm not going to get distracted." The only way to overcome distraction is by focusing your attention. And you've got to get the right attention and get your attention on the good things and the right things in life. A passage of Scripture that I read frequently in my own life is this, Hebrews 12:1. "Therefore, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, we have the testimonies of people who've gone before us, fought the battles we fight. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus." The only way that you can stay on the course, the only way that you can run the race, the only way that you can hit the finish line with faithfulness is not just by you trying to avoid distraction, but by you getting your attention on someone whose name is Jesus, who can deliver you from the tendency of the destructive impulses of distraction in your life. And so next week, we'll go back and talk about more about how to gain that focus and keep that focus that we all need in our lives together. And so I want you to plan to come and be with us. Okay, that's it. You got to go. Bye. Thank you for being here today.